Hello. It's time for another episode of Crime Wave, the podcast featuring mystery, thriller, and suspense authors and the stories behind their stories. Crime Wave is part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Bonner Spring, and today I'm joined by Elizabeth Crowens. Elizabeth has worn many hats in the entertainment industry, contributed stories to Black Bell, Blackgate, Sherlock Holmes Mystery Magazine, Hell's Heart, and the Bram Stoker-nominated A New York State of Fright. I love that title, A New York State of Fright, and has a popular caption contest on Facebook, which we might talk about later. Her awards include the Leo B. Bernstein Scholarship from the New York Chapter of Mystery Writers of America, Foundation of the Arts grant to publish New York, Give Me Your Best or Your Worst, a photo illustrated anthology, an Eric Hoffer Award, Glimmer Train Awards, honorable mentions, 2 grand prize and 5 first prize Chanticleer Awards. Elizabeth writes multi-genre alternate history, and today we're going to be talking mainly about her latest book, a delightful mystery called Hounds of the Hollywood Baskervilles that will be released in March of 2024. So welcome to Crime Wave, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I loved the up-close and personal look at the celebrities that sparkle on the pages of Hollywood. Hounds of the Hollywood Baskervilles. Why don't you start us off by name-dropping a bunch of the Hollywood A-listers from the 1930s who appear in your book?
Well, it's actually for 1940. Okay. And the main, celebrities would be Basil Rathbone, who played Sherlock Holmes, of course, in 1940 in Hollywood, and Myrna Loy and William Powell, who played Nick and Nora Charles in the Thin Man series. So they are the main actors, you might say, that get involved with my protagonist and her partner to solve the mystery. And then you've got some secondary characters, such as Dashiell Hammett, who, of course, wrote The Thin Man. And even Errol Flynn makes an appearance.
That's right. That's part of what was so much fun about this, seeing these folks, as your bio says, imagining an alternate history in which this sort of thing happening. Now, the fun and the challenge of running a podcast called Crime Wave is to intrigue our listeners with the premise without leading them too far down the path. So what's the quick setup for Hounds of the Hollywood Baskervilles?
Basically, it's Sherlock Holmes meets the Thin Man, when 2 young detectives recruit the on-screen actors to uncover the mystery behind missing celebrity pets in 1940s Hollywood. And it starts out in the first chapter where our protagonist, Babs Norman, and her partner, Guy Brandt, are in a vet's office. They've rescued some kittens, and they happen to notice Basil Rathbone comes in with a stack of flyers. He's totally distraught. He always has 5 dogs, and one of his dogs, his Cocker Spaniel named Leo, is missing. And could you imagine if you either worked for the LAPD or for the City Pound in 1940 and Basil Rathbone came in your office and said, "Can you help me find my dog?" And then, you know, the poor guy got laughed at. They said, "Sherlock Holmes has lost his dog. Give me a break. Go find him yourself. You're the world's greatest detective." So that's kind of how it jumps off.
Yeah, that's a really good introduction. Thank you for that. So of course, with all that, like I said, the Hollywood A-listers in your story, because I'm not necessarily a big film buff, I had to Google the name of your main protagonist, Babs Norman, thinking maybe you'd pulled her out of somewhere. But no, apparently she is a product of your own imagination. Was there an inspiration for her, though?
Yes, actually, there was. My best friend, who would.
Oh, wow.
She would be 101 years old this year if she were still alive. But she actually was an actress in the 40s in Hollywood. She was also a model, and she sang. And she quit the business. She couldn't deal with being beautiful and getting hit on all the time. And I ended up meeting her when she was in her 80s. And believe it or not, we met as a result of, one of the many hats I wore in Hollywood. I used to be an independent consultant and provide for film, theater, and television productions, vintage clothing and textiles. And I was one of the few people in the New York area who actually specialized in menswear as well. And almost nobody did it. There were very few of us. And I had an enormous collection. And she met me at a vintage clothing show. And her husband had just passed away. And he was a serious clothes horse. And I ended up buying $10,000. Or actually, I made $10,000 for us. Okay, I did not buy $10,000 worth of clothes. I sold $10,000 worth of clothes to the costume department for American Gangster, starring Denzel Washington. And when the movie came out, I took her to the movies with me, and we were pointing out at the actors on the screen who was wearing her late husband's clothing and accessories. So she is the, so what happened, long story short, is she had a very, very interesting life story. And I have hours recorded on tape, and I ended up becoming the executor of her estate. And with the lawyer that we were working, the estate lawyer that we were working with, she gave me the rights to her life story. And I was just launching my very first book, which was more science fiction fantasy. This was Silent Meridian, which she did get to go to my book launch. And I was trying to figure out how to package her, because memoirs are very, very difficult to sell unless you're really famous. And she was not famous. So what I ended up doing was, all of a sudden, one day the light bulb went off. And I said, I figured it out. I know how to market you. And she wanted to know the answer. And I told her, I said, we're going to make you a private eye. And she was, this was a woman who loves animals. Okay. This was a woman, every time I saw her, she was either reading a book from the library that was a mystery, or she was watching Murder, She Wrote, NCIS, Law and Order on television, or an animal show like Nat Geo Wild. So I said, how would you like it that you are a actress turned PI in 1940s Hollywood, and you love it, somehow get involved with animals, and that's going to be your story. And we'll incorporate some of these real stories into your fictional character. She said, I love it. So she gave me her blessing. We got all the legal documents signed. And, you know, unfortunately, I was hoping to write it and get it published before she passed away. So I have dedicated my book to her. But that she is the inspiration for Babs Norman.
Thank you so very much for that. What a great, absolutely lovely story that is. Thank you so much. So Babs Norman, a actress turned dog loving PI, and her partner are really shine on the pages. I wanted to ask you, this is a little bit off topic. Have you ever read any of Lawrence Block's Bernie Rodenbaugh series?
Elizabeth, no, you know what I'm talking about? Write that down.
Because I have to say that he has, Bernie is a bookseller turned burglar.
And oh, no. His best,
oh, I'm sorry. I said that wrong. Oh. He's a burglar turned bookseller. He needed a source of steady income. Why he picked a bookstore, of course, you and I have no idea. But anyhow, he did that. And his relationship with Carolyn, who's a dog groomer, brings a lot of animals into the story. And the banter back and forth between the two of them actually reminded me a great deal. So for anyone listening who's interested in this, a similar kind of thing, these stories are all almost 20 years old right now. I read them a long time ago, but right. Lawrence Block just came out. He said about 10 years ago, he's not going to write anymore. And this year, a new Bernie Rodenbaugh story is coming out. So I'm excited.
That's great. I'll have to check it out.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Now, you've talked a little bit about how your background influences, particularly Babs Norman and stuff, but what other sorts of things did you have to do to create this wonderful pastiche of the real characters and the dog nappings and all of that stuff?
Well, if you are familiar with my previous books, the Alternate History series, it's a Time Traveler Professor series. And basically, I explore kind of the paranormal interest of Arthur Conan Doyle. And I, because that's why he tried to kill off Sherlock Holmes to begin with. He really was very interested. He was an original Victorian Ghostbuster, basically. He loved the seances and anything paranormal he was, and he, believe it or not, used to write a lot of ghost stories, short stories, and some really good ones, actually. But I had been a Sherlockian for many, many years, and had, of course, read the canon, and I had read a lot of his other stuff, both fiction and nonfiction, spiritualism, psychic, as well as some of his historical fiction and historical nonfiction. So I was really familiar with Arthur Conan Doyle. And when I knew I was going to be creating the Babs Norman series, I decided in 1940, okay, Sherlock Holmes. Who was Sherlock Holmes in 1940? Well, it was Basil Rathbone. So immediately I started watching all the movies again. I actually listened. He's done a lot of radio shows. I listened to a lot of the radio shows. And I also picked up biographies, you know, biographical material on him. Mm-hmm. And he was really into dogs. He always had like five dogs. And he did have, in the first two chapters, he talks a little bit about the backstory of Leo, which is the missing Cocker Spaniel. And that's a true story. About his best friend getting hit in a car wreck while walking the dogs. And I figured, oh, wait a minute, I've got an angle here. I said, I've got all this background on Sherlock Holmes. He's a Hollywood actor in the right time period and the right place. And then I've got this female PI that's a sucker for rescuing animals. And I figured, oh, we got to throw in him. You know, it's got to be Basil Rathbone. And I'm a serious plotter. I mean, a really serious plotter. I mean, I could easily come up with an outline of 90 pages. You know, I'm really, really a stickler because everything I write is historical fiction. And, but every so often, and I'm doing this right now with my current work in progress, I'll look at the outline and I'm saying, okay, I'm stuck. You know, and it's like, okay, time to do a little pantsing here, you know, and see what kind of flows together and maybe I'm overlooking something. And at that point, I'm thinking, yeah, there's got to be something else going on here. And then lo and behold, TCM that night was the Thin Man. And I watched, I said, that's it. We're putting them in there. And then, of course, with the Thin Man, I figured, hey, we could put Dashiell Hammett. You know, and I started at throwing in at a bunch of the people at that point, and it just started coming together. And I had a lot of fun with it. So
you did. You had a lot of fun. Actually, we had a lot of fun reading it too, I guess is what I want to say. It's funny when I thought about asking you that question, I imagined you'd say something simple, like watching old movies, but it was a much more interesting story than that, after all. You've talked in great and yet in amusing detail about some of the influences on your writing. Are there other influences I haven't asked you about yet that you want to talk about? Or is that sort of a dead end question at this point in time?
Well, obviously in this one, Conan Doyle was a huge influence, but I had a background on that one. So what I wanted to do was kind of have her, Babs, use some of the Sherlockian reasoning to try to solve the case. So very much as Basil or anybody else who played Sherlock Holmes would go about doing it. So I was constantly kind of referring to that. And actually, without giving a spoiler, she refers back to the canon to actually solve the crime.
Good job. Excellent. I'm so glad I managed to ask you that. Yes, good question. I have been thinking a lot about how I've changed as a writer. And you've been active over several years in several different genres. You talked a little bit about being a serious plotter. Has your approach to writing changed over the years?
Yes. This is like a long, crazy story, but my the first of the science fiction fantasy alternate history series, Silent Meridian, I had started that. And I think I came up with the first draft of roughly 1983. And it was like 1,000 pages, you know, and I didn't know anything about the craft of writing. And we're talking about on an electric typewriter. This before we had computers. And I was totally a pantser back then. So, and when I started, it ended up going in a box and hid in a closet for a very long time because life happens, you know, I just had a million things happen. So I ended up working in film production and the natural default because my bachelor's degree was in photography and cinematography and film studies. I ended up breaking in as a still photographer and eventually joining the union out in Los Angeles. But again, working long, ridiculous hours. And if I wasn't working, I was hustling for the next job. It was a constant hustle. And I was lucky to have time to spend with my son. So the writing thing, I mean, I knew it was there, but it stayed in a box, you know, that original manuscript for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I ended up pulling it out of the box many years later and said, hey, you know, I've got this manuscript that I've been just kind of sitting on for a while. Maybe I should take another look at it. And that's when I started learning the craft and finding that it was nearly impossible for a first-time author to sell 1,000-page manuscript. Maybe I should, you know, break this up into several books, kind of this epic fantasy series. And, I kind of learned the craft by the seat of my pants, too. And, on that first book, because I really had no idea what the craft was, I ended up hiring, I think, 3 different editors out of my own pocket before I submitted it to a publisher. And so I felt like I was learning as I went along. So So I don't work that way now.
Right. I think we have all learned. That's funny. I committed the cardinal sin for my debut novel, which actually landed an agent. I changed it so many times over the years, but even after I got an agent, it was like, no, you need to cut out the first 3 chapters because that's all backstory. You need to really start it here. You know, I think we all learn as we go along. So now that you've learned all this stuff, I have to ask you what you're writing now. If you can share a little bit about it, would you please do that for us?
Oh, absolutely. I am writing the sequel to Hounds of the Hollywood Baskervilles. I have a 3-book deal with Level Best Books. So the second book, you get a hint in the last chapter. No dogs die, of course. The dogs get rescued, okay? Again, without giving away too much of the plot. And there's a big celebration party as a result on the MGM studio lot. And a lot of, you know, not only is the mayor of the city of New York, I'm sorry, not New York, Los Angeles, the police chief, you know, a lot of big mucky mucks are being invited to this, but also anybody whose dog had been stolen and recovered. And it happens to be that one of the dogs that was stolen was a Newfie, that was named Cappy, that was owned by Humphrey Bogart. And he did not bring the dog with him to the party. A lot of people did bring the dogs. Because if you've ever seen a Newfie, they're like the size of St. Bernard. They're absolutely huge. Yes. And he was afraid that the dog might get excited and jump on like a little kid or something and knock them down. But he ended up having a conversation with Guy Brandt, who is Babs's partner. And they exchanged business cards. And before they exchanged business cards, they have a little conversation because Guy was also a former actor. And he could act tough, but he doesn't look tough. You know, he's a small guy. He's maybe about 5'7", probably barely weighs 130, super dapper dresser. And he gets the patsy. He gets the stool pigeon roles. He gets the soda jerk. He gets the filling station. Would this guy ever get a flat foot, you know, type of role? No. Whereas, you know, Bogart has the look, you know, plus the acting chops, but he's got the look that he could play the heavy noirish type of character. So they talk a little about the acting profession. He gives him his card and he said, well, you know, you never know. Somebody might hit you up for blackmail. You know, because he said, well, you know, hopefully I'll never lose another dog. And he said, you know, it's not really what we do on a regular basis. We're PIs. We do normal, you know, investigations, spouses cheating, people, you know, trying to buck their bills. And he said, you never know what happens. You know, for all you know, somebody might try to blackmail you on something because they know you've got money or whatever. He said, feel free to call me. And that's who shows up in chapter one of Bye Bye Blackbird. So somebody has threatened Humphrey Bogart, and he is going to be the central character of book two.
Oh, wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Now, before we go off the air, please tell everyone listening where you're active online, where we can find you and hear a little bit of, maybe say just a little bit about the Give Me Your Best or Your Worst piece that you do on Facebook. I meant to ask you about that, but let's give a little plug for that because it's so much fun.
Oh, sure. No, if you go to my website, www.elizabethcrowens.com, you can sign up for my monthly newsletter. As part of my newsletter, I give out almost every month. Sometimes I do get really busy, but almost every month I give out a free ebook called Best of the Caption Contest. And if you friend me on Facebook, and I am discriminatory, so it looks like we have zero, you know, friends in common, or you've got a funky post, I might not, you know, accept your friend request on Facebook, but you can always go after me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter and I'm also on Instagram, but I post twice a day. Usually it's a vintage photo. And since I write historical fiction, and in the morning I have caption contests, give me your best or your worst. And I usually have a provocative or funny or bizarre vintage photo, and everybody who I'm connected with on Facebook will make a comment. And I get some really brilliant comments from some major writers. I mean, it's really kind of fun to see who responds and how they respond to this. And in the evening, I usually post a second one called Wrong Answers Only, which is usually a movie still from and of course that's my background. I used to be a still photographer on movie sets, but it's usually an old fashioned movie still. Sometimes it's from an obscure movie that you have absolutely no idea, and I don't even know where it came from. Or it could be a very popular movie like Ghostbusters or something, and you know right away exactly which movie it's from. And people will come up with wrong scenarios is exactly what's in that image. Yeah. And then what I do is I'll take some of the better ones and I'll make a little free ebook. It's not for sale. I'm not allowed to sell it, actually, because some of these are not images are not in public domain. But as long as it's free, you know, it's fine. And I will give people who subscribe to my monthly newsletter an option to download a free ebook every month of Best the Caption Contest. So it's pretty popular.
That's great. I have to say that the photographs that Elizabeth shares are really thought-provoking. I don't think I comment quite as often as some other big deal writers do, but I always enjoy them. Anyhow, I really want to thank you for taking time to come in and talk today, Elizabeth. And I really hope that you have a tremendous amount of success with Hounds of the Hollywood Baskervilles for sale in March of 2024 and come back when the Humphrey Bogart book is done.
Yes. Okay. The Bogart book is going to be called Bye Bye Blackbird.
Ooh, come back for Bye Bye Blackbird. You heard it first here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.